Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
Coming up on episode 284 of Wheel Bearings, we've got special guest Kelly Funkhauser from Consumer Reports to talk about their driver assist study. We've got the Cadillac CT4 Blackwing, the Hyundai Palisade. Ford gets back into Formula One with Red Bull. The IRS updates their EV classifications for the clean vehicle credit. It's easy to steal older Hyundai and Kia models with a key. And VinFast delays its deliveries. All that and more coming up next. This is episode 284 of Wheel Bearings. I am Sam Abual-Samich from Guidehouse Insights.
And I am Nicole Wakeland from Let's Go with Auto Vitel this week.
And I am Roberto Baldwin, and oh man, I don't know. Let's say Tom's Guide.
Okay. And we're joined by a very special guest today, Kelly Funkhauser from Consumer Reports. Hello, Kelly.
Hello. Fabulous to be here.
We're glad to have you here with us. So the reason why I reached out to you this time was because Consumer Reports a couple of weeks ago published a report. You did some comparison testing of driver assistance systems and had some interesting results. Let's put it that way. Well, first, tell us what you do at Consumer Reports.
Sure. So I oversee all of the vehicle technology testing. So there's basically three different bins of the technology test. So the first and the one related to what we're talking about today is all things ADAS. So all things advanced driver assistance systems, active safety, everything from the performance, the usability, the safety metrics, all of those things. And then the other two slightly unrelated to today's conversation are the infotainment and in-vehicle technology usability, ergonomics, human factors, and last but not least, telematics and vehicle communication. So everything from those, you know, cellular and V2X type of cars talking to things areas. So all the fun stuff really is what it is I do.
Excellent. So tell us, what was the approach that you took in putting together this test of these ADAS systems, and how did you select the vehicles? What vehicles did you use? And the systems that you tried out?
Yeah, so we have been testing in using essentially the same rubric, test metrics, everything for going on almost 6 years now. So our first publication of testing and putting these systems up against each other was back in 2018. And we looked at the same five categories that we're looking at today, which I'll get into in a minute. But back in 2018, those vehicles were selected. There were four systems that were essentially the ones making the headlines, ones with a name, right? Autopilot, co-pilot assist, and Super Cruise, and pilot assist. So those were the four systems we tested. Taken us up now, we're back to 2 years ago in 2020. We did similar testing in terms of the categories and the metrics and procedures, but we decided to put in the best available lane keeping, lane centering system along with adaptive cruise control from each brand, whether or not those were the lane systems were truly lane centering or lane keeping. We wanted to put all of the brands in there to give consumers information kind of about where generally the brands, you know, stack up against each other. And then bring us to today. We decided to omit those very few brands that don't truly have a lane centering system so that we could compare more of the apples to apples instead of putting a few of those oranges at the bottom there. That's how we decided the systems. And just one caveat on that, there are some brands that do have these systems that were not included in the report. And everyone's probably tired of talking about the supply chain issues by this point, but we as at Consumer Reports we purchase all of our vehicles for our test program anonymously at full retail price. And so we have run into, unfortunately, a lot of the supply chain issues in getting our vehicles into our test program over the past, little while. And so we were unable to get a handful of them, notably, a Subaru vehicle, a Jaguar Land Rover vehicle, and others into the test during that small time frame. So I think that kind of gives all the background and how we are and where we are today.
Great. So what, these systems, there's kind of a pretty broad spectrum of capabilities across these systems, from full hands-free systems like Super Cruise and Blue Cruise to systems where you're very explicitly meant to keep your hands on the wheel. How do you actually conduct the testing?
Okay, so I'm going to start by not answering your question really quick to give more background. I think, and some of the feedback and conversations I've had in the past little while since these have come out is, I like to start with what this is not, what we did not do. Okay. And what we did not do is test hands-free-ness. We didn't test the capabilities of hands-free. We didn't test whether or not you can be hands-free, any of that. That was not included. So what it is essentially adaptive cruise control and lane centering features that are active simultaneously. So no lane change assist, no hands-free-ness. Many of the vehicles in the test have those additional capabilities, but those were not part of the test. They didn't receive or lose points for having additional capabilities. So yes, there are vast differences in additional capabilities beyond these two features, but that is not included in the test.
Okay, so that right there, that explains some things that starts to explain some things in terms of the results.
Exactly. I should have put a huge banner like across the top on everything to make it very clear. Because
we kept our hands on the wheel.
Yes.
Did not take them off the wheel. We kept our hands on the wheel.
That's right.
So how do you actually score these vehicles? Is it a checklist? Here's the capabilities they have, and if it has these capabilities, we give it a point. Or do you actually go out and evaluate them? What is your process for figuring out what the scoring should be for each of these systems?
Yes, to all of the above. A lot of it is, does it have this in terms of ease of use, right? So that's the cleanest and clear cut, does it have it type of stuff where we're looking at, does it have effective and appropriate materials to explain these features to the drivers while they're in the vehicle? What do the symbols and on the controls and the displays and all of that look like? Is that cohesive, right? If you have no idea what this crazy new symbol in your car is, can you look that up? Right? Like, is there a way to figure that out? So ease of use stuff is the easiest type of checklist. In terms of all of the other things, it really is performance evaluation. So we do a lot of that on our test track in Connecticut. And then we also do, this time around, we did a 50-mile loop on public roads. So that includes both all of the neighborhood type streets, secondary roads, and limited access divided highways.
Okay. So let's go. You've got five categories that you're scoring, or five criteria that you're scoring these systems on. Let's go through them one by one a little bit and get a better understanding of what you're actually looking for. So capabilities and performance is the first one. What are you specifically looking for there in terms of capability, especially since you're explicitly not looking for hands-free? What other things are you looking for?
Right. So we're looking for how well those two features, adaptive cruise control and lane centering, perform. So in terms of adaptive cruise control, we're looking at, how well it performs in terms of acceleration and deceleration, both, getting up to set speed or even when you're lowering the set speed, when another vehicle either departs the lane, how much hesitation is there before your vehicle starts to speed up again. And also, when a car cuts in front of your lane, how quick is it to react and things like that. For lane centering, we're looking at centeringness, essentially, right? And that doesn't necessarily mean like zero deviation from the center point within the lane. We're looking also at some subjective measures as in terms of, you know, on curves, is it hanging towards the inner or outer? If you're in the right lane, does it hang towards, you know, the left side of that where the traffic is, or towards the right, you know, all of those types of things in terms of centeringness. and then, yeah, so comfort basically of the lane position while driving on all of these different types of road relative to other traffic.
So I found this one kind of interesting, you know, with the scoring that you came up with. I guess before we go on, can you tell us specifically which models, which vehicles you tested for Ford, for GM? And let's look at the top four: Ford, GM, Mercedes, and BMW. Which specific vehicles did you evaluate?
Yes. So for Ford, we used the Mustang Mach-E with Blue Cruise. For GM, we used the Cadillac Escalade. For Mercedes, we used the C300. And BMW was the i4.
Okay. So you gave a slightly higher score to Blue Cruise versus Super Cruise, and actually an even higher score for Mercedes-Benz on this capabilities and performance. And what was it about those systems that got you scoring them the way they did?
Yeah, so the Mercedes one, I think, is kind of its own unique animal. It was basically seamless lane centering where, as a driver, you almost feel that the car isn't doing a whole lot of effort to keep you in the center of the lane. And by that, I mean the actual experience of when your hands are on the wheel and maybe, you know, you're avoiding a pothole or you know, moving your car over to one side of the lane to give breath to another driver. It feels as though the vehicle is not intruding or applying any resistance to that steering wheel, and you truly are a collaborative team. And then it very quickly, say you were to, and I'm not recommending you to, you know, go, you're avoiding a pothole and you go over to one side of the lane line, and then you were to essentially let go of the steering wheel, right? It very, very smoothly brings you right back to the center of the lane line, or the lane, very, very quickly and smoothly. So you're not getting a lot of this jerkiness or ping ponging within the lane. It is very decisive and confident. In terms of kind of the two big ones that everyone's talking about, right? Blue Cruise and Super Cruise. So those are both either, you know, they have a little bit more hesitation or they have a little bit more ping-ponging when you're doing that. Now I'm going to say with the Super Cruise, you actually can't do that. You cannot drive over to one side of the lane line within the lane without it deactivating. So of course that'll come in another category of collaboration. But with the Blue Cruise, you're not going to get that as smooth as the Mercedes, but they're all very highly capable, performing, competent systems. So they're all up there, just some of those slight variations.
Okay, let's move on to keeping the driver engaged, because these are all, every one of these systems today is a supervised system where the driver is meant to keep at least eyes on the road and in some, depending on the mode, hands on the wheel. In some cases, they do allow some hands off, but you weren't looking at that. So how did you evaluate driver engagement?
Yeah, so it's that collaboration first and foremost. Okay. So in order for drivers to truly understand their role, they need to be able to be a team. So systems such as Tesla's Autopilot and GM Super Cruise both deactivate in slightly different ways when the driver applies their own steering. And so that gives drivers the perception that either the system's doing it or I'm doing it, but we're not doing it together. And all of the other brands out there allow this collaboration. So again, I can, you know, slowly steer to avoid a pothole or give breath to another vehicle, or even just, you know, help it out if I want to on a curve. You know, say I'm going well over the speed limit, not that I recommend that either. You know, and I know that this curve's a little tighter.
We don't exceed drive the speed fast limit. Cars.
No. No, of course not.
Not one.
Exactly. So say I want to, you know, help it out in advance, you know, I can do that with these other vehicles, but with Tesla, as soon as you know, kind of start to apply your own steering wheel, it kind of pops out of the auto steer, right? It turns that part off. And now you're completely taking over. So there's no collaboration. And then with Super Cruise, it's I have had some GM people say, well, ours doesn't deactivate, but then they say, well, you know, it was active and then it, and now it's not active because it's in standby, which of course means it's now been deactivated, right? It's no longer active. So
semantics.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's the semantics of it. So
the light,
so
it the goes light bar into is blue.
Standby. Right. Which, yeah. And when the light bar is blue, there is no steering, you know, being provided by the vehicle. Right. So it's essentially right. off. But it's now just in this limbo, confusing state, which they call standby, where it's going to be on if it decides it wants to turn back on. And now it's kind of like, I'm in control again, right? Like it's not on. And then, boom, now I just turned it back on again. And it's just confusing. So it's deactivated. Okay. So really keeping the driver engaged is about telling the driver what their responsibility is and allowing them to be engaged. So you can't keep them engaged if they were never allowed to be engaged. So that's definitely the most important part for that category.
Fair enough. Although, you know, and I'm not sure if this really, if this falls into this category or one of the other criteria, maybe it falls under clear when it's safe to use, is, you know, that indication to the driver of what is the current state. You know, what is the current mode, and should your hands, you know, be on the wheel, or, you know, should you be in full control or partial control? And this is one of the issues I've had, particularly with Blue Cruise versus some other systems. And it's actually less of a problem on the Mach-E than it is, say, on the F-150 or the Lincoln Navigator, where those other vehicles, in the instrument cluster, the color theme that they use, the visual theme that they use in the instrument cluster, because they don't have a light bar or some sort of lighting system in the steering wheel, you're relying on icons in the cluster. So you have to glance down at the cluster and look, and particularly on the F-150, and I assume you've tried that one at some point, you know, because it's this predominantly blue theme. It's not always immediately obvious when, especially when it has changed modes and when it wants you to put hands on the wheel.
So I'm gonna turn this around back on you because I already know where you're going with this, and I have a rebuttal.
Okay.
So first of all, again, we're not testing hands on the
sure.
wheels or not, but and I agree with you that the feedback to drivers of whether or not they should have their hands on the wheel is confusing, but. In terms of, you know, just this testing of the modes of, you know, let's call it the lane centering aspect being on or not. Going back to what I said with the Super Cruise example, right? So it needs to give you, like, it has to have that light bar because of its failure and inadequacies of allowing the driver to collaborate with it, because you have to know if you're doing something or it's doing it. Whereas all of these other systems, if I, as a driver, turn on the air conditioning, I expect it to turn on and not decide that, well, actually, I think it's a sunny day, but it's, you know, not that hot, so I'm going to turn it off until I decide that I want to turn it back on. As a driver, if I turn on a feature, it should be on. And because with Super Cruise, it has this standby mode where it now is in control of what mode it wants to be in, it better have something to tell you that it's changed that mode. So all the other brands out there, again, not including Tesla, the system stays active, even if you steer within the lane. Even if you, most of them up to your vehicle has a quarter cross the lane line, they're still staying active. And again, if I were to let go of the steering wheel, they're going to recenter me in the lane. Now, of course, how well they do that and quickly, that's another story. But they're all active. I'm in control. I know exactly what the system is doing because I turn it on. So by saying Super Cruise has this beneficial light bar, they're doing that because they have a failure in another aspect of their design that requires them to, they better be giving people feedback that I just stopped steering the car.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, I can live with that. That's a perfectly reasonable rationale for how you scored it. And I think it makes sense. You know, given the way the systems are designed to operate, that makes perfect sense. All right, so ease of use.
Yeah, so this is largely, again, about the conveying to drivers what these systems are and are not capable of and being able to turn them on. So, you know, the actual number of steps is also included. You know, it takes one step. The autopilot is fairly easy to activate, right? You push the stop down once, or you push it down twice, or if you're in, you know, a newer Model S or something, it's on the steering wheel. Those are fairly simple to activate. But a lot of the systems also, and similar to Tesla, require adaptive cruise control to be on prior to using the lane centering system. That, again, can confuse drivers, especially when if turning on the lane centering component of the system is done through a menu versus a button, right? So if you have this toggled on somewhere deep in some menu, driver screen, center screen, wherever it was, and then you turn on the adaptive cruise control, if it's checked, it'll just all this. Now it's got lane centering beyond just adaptive cruise control, which also is, you know, not very clear to drivers, especially if they share the vehicle with another driver. So that would, you know, that they wouldn't get as many points in that area for that confusion. Again, it's mode confusion at that point, right? Uh-huh. And then also just the clarity and cohesion of the language of the vehicle. Again, so if there's some symbol on the steering wheel that you've never seen before and there's no reference to it in any menu or anywhere, or if you turn it on and it's, again, just the same symbol on the display, you have no idea what this thing does. How could you ever even go and look up what it does, right, without knowing already something about this system? And so we're looking for cohesion. First of all, does it give you information in the car? Because we know, you know, owner's manuals, people aren't going to do that. Does it give you...
Assuming there's even an owner's manual in the car.
Which mostly there aren't, exactly. So yes, all of those kinds of things go into the ease of use component of that, of what they're calling it, how they're conveying it, cohesion in the car, and just simplicity and clear language.
I'm curious if, as part of your scoring in this one, whether you gave any consideration to the branding that companies use, because this is one of the things we've talked about in the past. You know, every manufacturer's got their own branding for different features like adaptive cruise control. Some call it intelligent cruise control, smart cruise control, radar cruise control, adaptive cruise control. Is that something that factored into your thinking on this particular score?
Absolutely. I'm going to plug myself again real quick here. So I put out another report in December. Basically, I think it was called CR's Guide to ADAS Usability Design. And in that, that's a deep dive into exactly this is, yes, there's branding. Yes, I understand branding in terms of what they call it, try to sell a feature, all of that. But I have been, my pet project for most of my life, even all the way back to grad school, was trying to clear the confusion about terminology used for describing and communicating these within or between consumers, dealers, automakers, the media. And so back in that report, if you want to take a look, I bet you would like that, Sam, actually.
I actually have read it.
Okay, that seems right up your alley.
I've seen you talk on this subject at conferences.
Okay, great, yes. Too, so. So myself, along with AAA, National Safety Council, JD Power, PAVE, and SAE as well. So the SAE JDocs, the standards that are out there now, J3063, which is the active safety terms and definitions, now aligns with this glossary of terms called clearing the confusion. Uh-huh. And so these are the words and terms and descriptions that are now the industry standard for these. You know, going back to your question about the branding, yes, that's important, but it's more important to have the owners understand these features, but it's also important for them to be able to buy the features they want on their car, right? So if you go to a dealer and you want to buy a safety feature, you're ready to put down extra money for it. And then it's called some crazy goofy name that you have no idea what in the world that means. And the sales guy was at a different dealer or brand, you know, a couple of weeks ago, because the turnover rate within the industry is just crazy. They have no idea what it is. They remember from the last one or whatever, right? The automakers aren't going to be able to sell these features to consumers if they aren't using, you know, clear language to them. So branding is important, but to what degree and when does it become, you know, a conflict for everyone in the industry?
All right. I agree with you 100%, you know, that we need this standardization of language around what the functions mean, what the features mean.
We all came up with cruise control, and then we stopped.
Yeah.
Like, everyone's like, it has cruise control. Even picked cruise control. Like, again, I'm all about, like, let's be descriptive. Like, it's speed control or speed assist, right?
Yeah.
So part of this is also understanding that, you know, some of the ships have sailed, and so working off of those. But again, yeah, it's to everyone's best interest to just try to use, you know, cohesive language standard that just makes sense. Bingo.
And as you said, you know, I think, you know, where the various buttons are, I think, you know, we're starting to get some coalescing on some of the iconography on these switches, especially, you know, we've had consistent iconography for things like traction control on or off for a long time. But now, you know, lane centering, you know, basically seeing something that looks like a pair of lanes converging into the
distance. Well, sometimes it's a steering wheel, sometimes it's a steering wheel and a lane, like, yeah, there's two lanes, but sometimes you have to have both of them on, or sometimes you have to have only one on.
Sometimes there's not another one.
Is it
buried on the left side of the dash?
It's so confusing.
So much this.
And I always figure, if we're this confused about it, and like, we drive cars,
that's our job, and I still sit down
and I stare at a car, I'm like, I don't even know how to turn this on. What hope does a consumer have?
Exactly. Yeah. That's human factors 101. Never blame the user. If I, as an expert, cannot figure it out, there's something going on here that is clearly a problem.
If I'm digging through menu, or it's a button, and you know those buttons to the left of underneath the steering wheel, you can't see them. If it's one of those, I'm like, why is it one of those?
And not lit, and
it's a hidden, like, dark button. You're just like, oh my gosh.
Preach.
Anything that you would ever actually want to use while you're driving should not be buried under the left side of the dashboard.
Hey, you're asking for help. Come on.
He's going to.
Calm down.
It's one thing, you know, put your trunk release down there. Fine.
Yeah, that's the trunk release area.
Right, when you're stopped and actively going to.
I got to let people.
All right. Okay. Clear when it's safe to use.
Yes. So this is a category that is actually really important to drivers, but they may not understand it, or oftentimes may blame others for being human. Again, people don't read the owner's manual. And if you were to read the owner's manual and go by the prescribed, what we call ODD, operational design domain, given by the manufacturers, oftentimes it's still a guessing game, because it's do not use it here. Do not use it here. It may not operate correctly in these all of the scenarios ever that have ever been invented, right? And so then you are left as the driver to make assumptions on when you think that it is safe to use, right? And that's not fair. That's setting up drivers to fail. And we've seen it time and time again. You know, the first thing when a crash happens, when a Tesla crash happens on autopilot, right? First thing we see they don't have a PR department, by someone that comes out and says, well, what was the driver doing, right?
Usually on Elon's Twitter feed, but
something, right? Yeah. Again, so the first thing we hear and see is, well, the driver was reading a book. The driver was watching a movie. The driver was asleep. The driver was what, right? And we never really ask, why was the driver able or enabled to do all of these different behaviors or tasks in this system? Why does the system not work or not allow the driver to use them in perhaps these environmental conditions, these roadway design areas, or even these, you know, distracting tasks while in the vehicle? And that's what clear when safe to use means, is does the vehicle not allow the system to be operated in the areas or roads or whatever that is what the manufacturer says it's not designed for? That's up to the manufacturer to put in that safeguard, right? Don't allow it to be used. If you can, you will. And also making that very clear to drivers while they're using the system. If something is detected in the environment or the driver is distracted, right, it's the onus is on the manufacturer for the system to provide some sort of warning to say, hey, something's going on, be more alert, or, you know, have some sort of an adequate driver monitoring system that will check to make sure the driver isn't falling asleep, right? So this is a don't blame the driver category more than clear when safe to use, because, you know, at Consumer Reports, more than just even in autos, we are advocates for safe products. And whatever it is, it's a, you know, a baby toy or whatever. If a manufacturer is going to put that product out into the world for sale, and there are very extremely foreseeable headline making risks, then that's often usually ends up in a recall, right? We aren't going that far right now to say that these systems should necessarily be recalled, but we are saying that there are very foreseeable risks when using these systems that have happened over and over and over again. And so it needs to be clear to the driver how the manufacturer is building into their design a safeguard to make sure that they have some responsibility in how these systems are being used.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, as an engineer, you know, when I started working on anti-lock brake systems more than 30 years ago, you know, one of the things that I learned early on working in product development was you have to think about the ways that that the driver is going to use or misuse the whatever it is you're putting on there, and do whatever you reasonably can to mitigate any potential misuse. One example that I often give, is one my boss at one time, we were out on a frozen lake testing out an ABS system, and he starts pumping on the brakes at about five pumps per second, which normally a driver would never do, but it turns out, that they had data showing that some drivers actually did that. And right. When that happened, if you didn't handle it right, you could end up in a situation where the system would just dump off all the brake pressure and now you have no brakes. And, that's something that, we knew could happen. And, we had to put in mechanisms in the software to avoid that happening. And what do you think about driver monitor systems, things like the infrared cameras we're starting to see on more and more vehicles now?
Yeah, so I am the biggest champion of them, and we actually have it in our scoring at Consumer Reports and the overall score of vehicles. It's in our test program that if you have a system with adaptive cruise control and lane centering, starting actually with model year 24, which will be coming out this year, vehicles are going to begin losing points from their overall score. And vehicles that do have it are going to be gaining points. And that's going to increase year over year for the next few years, so that the delta, the difference between vehicles that have adequate direct or infrared or camera-based driver monitoring are going to score much higher, just even in their regular road test scoring, than those that do not. And go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. I was just going to say that the final category, unresponsive driver, is that where you're taking into account whether they have something like that, or is that something different there, or is it how the system responds to an unresponsive driver?
It's how it responds in this category specifically, yes. But that is also a factor of what type of driver monitoring system is equipped in the vehicle, right? If it's a put your hands on the wheel or apply torque to the steering wheel, which can easily be defeated, or, otherwise, then, it's going to be much harder to detect that the driver is inattentive and then do something about it. But essentially, this last category of unresponsive driver is if you have a mechanism to detect that the driver is not engaged to whatever degree, like, it's not enough to just know that and be like, cool, bro, not engaged. Like, do something about it, right? Like, again, safeguard the driver. And so this is exactly that. What do you do about it, and how quickly, and what is that process?
So one of my other complaints, besides vehicles that don't have a driver monitor system, is with how they detect hands on the wheel.
Oh, torque.
Torque sensors are a terrible solution for that problem.
They're a non-solution. There are no data to show that they are better than nothing.
Right.
You're like, hey, I'm driving now, I'm just twitching. You're just creating twitching in the lane, which is terrifying to other drivers and yourself, actually.
And I've seen, we're part of, Consumer Reports is part of the MIT ABT Advanced Vehicle Technology Consortium, and we have videos of all of these drivers that drive all the types of cars, right? So we'll have videos of people driving Teslas where they'll be doing whatever, looking down at their phone or whatever they're doing. And then they'll get this alert that pops up, center screen, if it's a model Y or 3. And they'll see this and they'll kind of look up at the screen and see it. And they'll reach over and, just torque the wheel a little bit and then go back to exactly what they were doing until the next one comes, never looking at the road during that entire process, right? So Yeah.
Well, and the flip side of that as well is, you know, and this has been one of my complaints with Ford vehicles in the last couple of years, because they chose to use a torque sensor rather than capacitive sensors in the wheel, is I frequently get, when my hands are on the wheel, you know, if I'm on a straight road and I'm holding the wheel steady, I get false positives to put my hands on the wheel.
It's just yelling at you. And you're like, what do you want me to swerve like a drunk driver? Right? Like, yeah. You're telling me that's what? No, bad.
All right. So, that great explanation of what you've done. And it makes so much more sense now that you've explained it. You know, the obvious elephant in the room,
yes.
You know, as someone who regularly writes a leaderboard report on automated driving systems that frequently has Tesla at the bottom, you know, actually always has Tesla at the bottom of the rankings. I'm used to the grief I get when that comes out, and mm-hmm. the new one should be coming out in the next week or so. How do you, you know, a lot of people still see Tesla as kind of the leader in this space, and, you know, they came in, you know, mid-pack in your rankings. You know, how do you see Tesla, and what do you think Tesla should be doing differently?
Yeah, the easiest thing is have an actual adequate direct driver monitoring system. So first of all, their camera in their vehicle is not required to be used for autopilot. And again, this is autopilot we're talking about. We're not talking about all these extra features. We're not talking about full self-driving beta. It is not a requirement to use autopilot, which is the riskier of the two of those, you know,
and systems, I think you've demonstrated, you know, that you can just sit there and hold up a picture of yourself in front of the camera, because it's just an RGB camera. And fool it.
Right. Well, you could just cover it, right? Yeah. Like, and then it's just, it's not required to be on. For autopilot, that is. So that's the easiest thing, is make it required, and also improve that hardware, right? Make it infrared and all of these other things. That's the easiest thing. And so I get a whole lot of hate and stuff on social media too. It's
oh, we all do.
Energizing more than coffee, I'll tell you that. And again, we are not, this is not full self-driving beta. We are not testing full self-driving beta, because at this point it is not worth anybody's time or energy or sanity to even test or report on it, because it's a different animal. We'll call it that. And they haven't improved their regular, you know, autopilot in terms of allowing collaborative driving and steering, right? You can't do that. They don't have adequate driver monitoring. What they do is stay very rigidly in the center of the lane, for better or for worse. And that can be a negative in a lot of situations, especially say if there's a big truck driving on the lane, right? We've seen again through some of these studies that we participate in, where drivers in both Super Cruise and autopilot tend to allow the system to continue to drive, to steer on its own, into some closer, more risky scenarios like that, where there's a vehicle in their lane partially. They allow that more often than in other systems that have the collaborative driving, because it's a small thing, but it becomes a nuisance over time when you're continually, it's disengaging, you're disengaging it, and then having to re-engage it over and over and over again. So that is a huge negative, actually, for both of those systems. So those are some of the things that Tesla could easily do to bump up their score. And again, they just haven't done a whole lot on the autopilot side on those features in quite a few years now.
Okay.
Hey, Drew Scott here, and I'm Jonathan Scott, reminding you that life's better with a home policy from American Family Insurance. They can help you get just the right protection at just the right price, and help you save when you bundle home and auto. Kind of like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. It'll be just right for you. We love a custom build. American Family Insurance. Insure carefully. Dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Did you know you can support Wheel Bearings directly? Head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia and you can become a patron today. Your contributions will help fund the platforms and tools we use to bring the podcast to you. And exclusives and improvements are already on the way thanks to your generosity. So if you want to be part of an automotive podcast like no other, head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia. I've been hogging this conversation with Kelly, Robbie, Nicole.
No, I feel like you've been asking her the questions that I've been having as you were going forward. And a lot of your explanations, Kelly, really, I couldn't figure out why some systems were weighted higher than others. I'm like, wait, that doesn't make sense. And then when you've explained sort of your rationale and how you've gone through it and, you know, your process for what you evaluated, I'm like, oh, now I get it. Now it does make sense given the parameters that you guys had for what you were evaluating.
Right. And I'll just kind of go back to the top of this hour where I said, you know, we've been evaluating largely on the same metrics and everything now for several years. We were the first organization really to put out these five categories. Since then, IHS came to us, asked us for all of the details on it and have developed their test program based on ours. Same with Euro NCAP as well. And the reason that we put a lot of time and effort into developing these, wanting them to be robust and evergreen. But also in 2018, you know, it doesn't seem like that long ago, but people weren't talking about more than who was winning the race, right? Who's the latest and greatest and best and has all of the bells and whistles, right? No one was talking about safety. And since then, we just see, you know, crash after crash after crash of you know, vehicles that have these systems on. And so it just kind of reiterates, you know, the fact that we were trying to introduce safety into the conversation, why that was so important and still remains so today.
I'm curious for the drivers as they're doing the testing, how do they, I think what happens with us a lot of times is that we get used to these systems because we're driving them all the time. We're driving multiple systems and we have an engineer who will sometimes tell us how it works. Like, how do the drivers themselves, how do you make sure that they're not becoming comfortable to the point where they're more comfortable beyond the average driver? I think that's something that can happen with us where we're like, oh, well, it just works. This, you just push this and this, and then you go through this menu and you push this. It just works. How do you keep those drivers? Do you switch them out, or they just have to be very rigid in how they're evaluating?
You mean within CR for testing these?
Yeah, within CR.
Yeah, so experience is actually a benefit, not, you know, doesn't necessarily turn into complacency or anything like that, because we have the breadth of the market available to us, right? We're really one of the only testing organizations that have all of the vehicles all of the time, right? And also what sets us apart is that, you know, we're not necessarily getting the highest trim line directly from the manufacturer being provided to us. Again, we're going out and purchasing these vehicles. We're also purchasing the most representative trim, the highest volume one that's being sold to consumers. And so, you know, we have experience with both. We will rent higher trim line versions, and then we'll also see, you know, the different trims. So, you know, we're not becoming, you know, redundant and complacent in terms of these, because the technology, frankly, is just changing so fast that would be kind of almost difficult for us to do at this point. But no, being able to compare across the market and then identify these nuances is actually the benefit that comes with the job. Because, you know, if I were to just go into A, B, and C vehicles, I'd be like, yeah, they do kind of the same thing. But to have the expertise and seat time of noticing that, wow, this does this one thing in a slightly different way, and noticing those actually is part of our expertise.
And having those vehicles on hand to go back to back makes it easier to do that.
Which we do.
We typically
exactly.
Don't.
Yeah.
Like, I'll have a Mercedes 1 week, and then 3 weeks later I'll have a Ford.
Right. Like, well, it's also good for my sanity, honestly, because after this came out and everyone, you know, I get all the hate and stuff on social media. I've gone back and driven all of the vehicles again since then, just to be like, nope, it was right. So good for my sanity too. Yeah.
Well, that's always the especially when you're doing data driven the reporting, where you're always like, well, what if I got a decimal wrong? What if I did the math wrong on this?
Exactly, that's what keeps me up at night. I'm like, oh my goodness, are they right? Am I biased? Am I just totally messing this up? Did I have like this preconceived idea of what I want it to be? And then I go back and check. I'm like, no, you guys are just messing with me. You're just getting in my head. No, no.
I go through my spreadsheets. I've woken up at 3 in the morning, freaked out about like a number. And I'm like, wait, is that the right number? And then I'll get up and then I'm like checking it and I'm like doing math. And it's like 3:30 in the morning. I can't see.
Yes,
and I'm checking the article. It's about to go live in 3 hours. It's,
I feel you. I feel you.
It's very fun. Because someone's going to be mad at you.
That's how you know you're doing good. When both the fanboys and investors as well, when they all hate you equally, that's when you know you.
You're like, all right. Well, as long as everyone's angry, that's okay.
So the next time that you come back and revisit this, in a year or two, whenever it might be, do you plan at that point to start to look at hands-free systems as well, and maybe eyes-off systems like Mercedes Drive Pilot that just got approval from the state of Nevada?
Yeah, this is an interesting topic. I think that's not going to become part of this evaluation for foreseeable future, especially because, again, safety, right? So if you're going to allow the driver to take their hands off the wheel or, again, encourage it, right, then you better have some safeguard mechanism in there to ensure that their hands remain ready to take over control. If you're telling them they are legally and liably responsible to do so, don't set them up to fail again. So if there's a mechanism, a driver monitoring system component, add on where they can ensure that the driver's hands remain at the ready and you're not holding a giant, greasy, hot hamburger and then hotter coffee, right? And then you have to all of a sudden take over. Don't set them up for that, right? So allowing them to take their hands off the wheel may seem like this huge benefit, but at what cost does it come? So I think, if we start to see systems that are capable of ensuring their hands remain at the ready, then we might revisit it at that point.
Okay.
Do we need, when you test those systems, I don't know what to do with my hands. So they're like always just hovering.
I know,
put them on the wheel. I'm like, where am I going to put these?
Right. So what's the point?
I'm like,
exactly. Yep.
Cause I don't trust robots that much.
Right. But Sam, I do want to get back to your point about like the Mercedes one, their level 3 one that is slightly different because now they are taking the liability. They said that they are taking the responsibility for what the car does when your hands are off the wheel. So that does kind of introduce a new factor into the game. I'll have to see kind of what comes of it. We do have one of those vehicles in our fleet that is supposed to be able to be updated. So let me take a look and then let's follow up. More to come on.
We'll have to take a little trip out to Nevada.
Yeah. You got to go to Nevada.
Is it really?
Yeah.
It's geofenced to Nevada still.
Oh, okay.
And then it'll probably be California next. Because I know I talked to the CTO and they're working with the regulators in California, so they're trying to get California.
Okay, I did not know that. So that's interesting.
I don't want to go to Nevada.
That is not a wide consumer-release product. No.
Maybe you could combine it. Is it an EQS or an S-Class that you have?
Yes, EQS.
So maybe you combine it with doing a cross-country charging evaluation at the same time.
I'm not signing up for that. That does not sound like a fun game to me. They're all.
Nicole,
oh my goodness,
Nicole just did that a couple of weeks ago.
I did.
How many? Did you do a ratio of how many chargers were broken versus actually working?
Most. I didn't actually ratio it. I'm going to confidently say most, either broken, fully not working at all, or just throttled down so much. It's like, yeah, awesome. You plugged into a 350 kilowatt charger. Here's your 7 kilowatts. Enjoy.
I ain't got time for that.
Yeah, exactly. I did not have time for it either, but.
Well, good for you. I'm sure that will be really enlightening and helpful information, but yeah, I'm not signing up. Thank you. All of my appreciation goes to you.
All right. Well, Kelly, we really appreciate the time you've given us today. This has been a great conversation, and we definitely have to have you back. I really appreciate the work that you do at Consumer Reports and the advocacy that you do for safety. I think you do great work, and keep it up. And thanks for joining us today.
I was happy to be here, and I also had a great time. So thanks to everyone.
Thanks, Kelly. All right.
Take care.
Bye. All right. With that, let's go into what we've been driving. Who wants to go first?
Nicole? I ain't been driving nothing, so I'm just going to skip.
Oh, I'll go first. Okay. I'll go first. It's me. Okay, I am driving the 2023 Hyundai Palisade Calligraphy all-wheel drive. That's a lot of words. I'm just literally reading the
Again, marketing. Let's just go back to the whole marketing thing.
Well, oh, my gosh.
The one I'll be talking about next week has even more words than that, I think, which is the Kia Telluride SX Prestige X-Pro V6 all-wheel drive.
Oh, good.
I just want to lay
down.
Yours
doesn't have V6 in there, so.
You talk about ADAS features being complicated. What the heck did I just buy? Like, how do you even know? Okay, so the Palisade three-row SUV. I like the Palisade and the Telluride. I know Kia and Hyundai are, like, the same but not the same. They're both great values. Like, they have nice interiors. They have a good number of features. I like the Palisade. I like this one, the Calligraphy, which I want to say is at the top of the trim lineup. It's so fancy inside. It has, like, stitching on the seats that make it a little upscale. It's got all the features. It's very comfortable. It's fun to drive. I took it out. And here's the plus one for Hyundai. So it was yesterday when I got up. It was negative 12. Not with a wind chill. Just straight up negative 12.
Just curious, how far away are you from Mount Washington?
Far enough away that it was nowhere near that bleep it out.
I heard it was minus 108 with the wind chill Mount Washington.
So Mount Washington is a weird little animal that even though it's only about an hour and 45 minutes away from me, where it is, the mountains, location, whatever, it's its own little weather system up there. No matter what time of year you're there, it has different weather even than what's at the base of the mountain by far. It's its own little weather system, which is why they have that observatory up there that everybody saw in videos looking like something from like, oh, someone photoshopped this. Nope, that's what it is. A building encased in ice for about 2 or 3 months out of the year. So I was not that close to that. Nowhere near that. But we still have this crazy cold weather. And the number of people in my neighborhood who I saw trying to start their cars, they're like, oh, they're not starting. It was too cold. I saw little AAA trucks going around to help everybody out with batteries and jump starts. Like it was one of those mornings. And I went out there and turned the key and it didn't even hesitate. Or not turn the key, push the button. Didn't even hesitate. Didn't even
good,
think
good
for
thing
a
you
second.
Had a push button, because otherwise somebody might have stole it. But we'll get to that later.
Yeah, no, I'm not. Yeah, right. That's a whole different story. But so I was actually pretty impressed that it was running with no problem. Because even sometimes in that kind of cold weather, your car starts and it's sort of like, you want me to do what? Like as it shifts gears and things, you can feel that it's too cold. It just wants to warm up.
It's like,
everything's a little sluggish. Nope, this was fine. So plus one for handling negative 12 air temperatures in New Hampshire without any hesitation. Also, plus 9 bazillion for having heated front seats, a heated steering wheel, and a heated second row. No one was in the second row, but I'm sure my children would have been very appreciative because that's something that they normally notice when it's cold. Like, what kind of car is this that doesn't have a heated second row? Like, a normal car. Get over it, child. But I really like the Palisade. I think it has, you know, it's that family vehicle. You're not just buying this probably if you're just a couple. It's got three rows of seating. It's designed to have a whole family in it. It has all the, you know, a million cup holders. It has a huge center console that you can store. Like, I love that there's a spot for your drinks and there's a spot like a flat, like the charging pad, the Qi wireless charging is in there. But there's still a little bit of space there so you could throw some stuff. But then you still have the cut, like the center console that has the cover on it, and you can put more stuff in there. So there's a lot of storage in this, and I appreciate it.
It's a cubbyhole extravaganza.
It's a cubbyhole extravaganza.
I also like how Hyundai and Kia have the USB charging ports on the inner panel on the seat back, the front row seats, so it's nice and easy to reach there.
Yeah,
like you're on a plane where you have to reach down like to the center console and you're right?
feeling
like,
around trying to find the.
It's in the dark, or it's or it's inside, and you're like, I can't even get that angle to reach inside of that cubby to plug that. Where is it? Yeah, so they don't do that. The other thing, you know what I really like, because that third row access can be a bear for kids, because if kids just flip over the second row seats, their feet hit the roof of your car and you have those nice little marks on your interior because your kids ask me how I know from days gone by. But even when there's captain chairs like this one had and you can squeeze between, it's still kind of a narrow fit. And if you're an adult, you're really squeezing between. There's a button. I hate latches and levers and all these things. I'm like, how do I get out of the third row? Someone just let me out of the third row. Because then if they don't let you out, if someone hops out of the car, you're like, hey, still back here. This one has this nice, easy button It's right on the top of the second row. You push the button. Just bloop, push the button. The seat tips forward and slides forward. So it gives you like full access to the third row. So you can't be left back there by your friends either accidentally when they shut the door and it's like, yep, you remember I'm back here, or like just to be obnoxious like my friends are. It's like, let me out of the car. So I liked that. It's like a little, it's a small detail that makes a big difference in your convenience in living with a car every day. This one also has buttons in the cargo area that will flip down and flip up the third row and flip down the second row. So you don't have to be running around outside the car like, okay, pull down the half, the front, you know, the second row. Now I'll do the, now I'll do the other half of the second row. Now come around the back and pull straps and get, no, you can just kind of like smash all those buttons at once when it's 12 below and all of your seats kind of go down together. So it just, it's a little convenience thing that makes it a little easier, less fussing around to try to get stuff in the car when you're switching back and forth from people to cargo. I like it. I like the Palisade. I think it looks good. I think it has great exterior and interior style. It's comfortable. It handles well. It has plenty of power. And it starts up when it's freezing cold.
Well, that is an advantage of having a brand new starter battery.
Yeah. Yes.
having a new car, you know, when your battery is, you know, 2-3 years old, it's been through a couple of those winters, you know, then we'll see if it still actually starts up.
But I have had, honestly, though, I have had, we don't generally get 12 below. That's like crazy talk for us. But even when it's really cold, we normally get at least a couple of days of the year where it's like maybe like -1. And we normally have a good stretch in January where it's like single digits. So still exceptionally cold weather that cars don't like. And I have had, you know, new automaker cars. I've never had one that wouldn't start, but I've had some that literally did that like it thinks about it. You have that moment of thinking, wait, is this not going to start? And then it kicks over. This didn't even have a pause. It wasn't even for a heartbeat. So I give it a gold star because it's like the coldest weather I think I've ever driven a car in.
When I lived in Kansas City for a little while, and it was -45 the winter I was there. Ugh. And I had my little 90 Honda Civic, and this was in the mid to late 90s.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the battery was, but that car started every morning. Nope. I was a baker at the time. I've had a lot of jobs. So I had to get up at 5 in the morning and drive my little Honda Civic to the Perkins restaurant where I was a baker. And it just started all the time. So I was really confused why people's cars were just like stuck. Like, I'm like, what's going on? What's happening here?
Yeah, but that Civic had this tiny little engine that, you know, you could basically, if you needed to, you could pop the hood, just, you know, grab the belt, give it a yank, and it would start itself.
It would just start up on its own.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was
not always much inertia there.
Yeah, but so I'm still trying. I'm like, wow, what was that battery? Because it wasn't a new battery. It was probably the battery that came with the car. So I always think about like what that battery was, because then I find out later, I'm like, oh yeah, you were just lucky.
Yeah, yeah. That battery failed all the time. Your car was just the one that worked.
Yeah. All right. And how much was the Palisade?
I just realized on the Monronia it is free. It's to be decided.
Free.
I have absolutely no TBD. They'll see when they sell it to you.
That's
right?
Value.
I'm going to look it up as we're talking here. Let's see. Okay. The Hyundai Palisade 2020. And this is a 23. Yep. So it's the 23. So, you know, their website's slow. It's thinking. It's still thinking.
Well, it starts at $35,550.
So you got it. Okay. You got it. What's the calligraphy?
The calligraphy is $49,500.
$49,500. Okay.
So 50, and did I have 50 grand. 50
so like
G's.
50 grand. And I had... Did I have extra goodies on here? No, I think most of what I have, I don't see anything that was like added. I think I pretty much have this trim.
What color did you have?
The way this trim. The color on this is, this is a great color name. I thought it was black, and it's not. Robust Emerald.
Oh, yeah.
That's robust.
Yes.
Yeah, robust. And you know
I like
what?
Emeralds, but I don't want like chintzy emeralds.
This is really cool. When you look at this, like until you're really right next to it, you don't know there's any green in this. It looks really, really
like
dark, sort
colors.
Of like a pearlescent-y kind of black. And then all of a sudden the light hits it just the right way and you kind of cock your head sideways like a dog and go, oh, wait, there's some color to that.
It's
and
green.
It's green. Yeah, yeah, it's actually a really pretty color.
Well, it looks like there's no options on there. Everything is standard on the calligraphy.
Yeah, it looks like it's just there's no added features. Oh, except for, I take that back. There are carpeted floor mats, which are listed as an added feature. So okay. I can't imagine that
there
changed the price much.
$12,000.
$12,000 extra for floor mats.
Okay. Well, I had, and you know, this car was delivered the day before we had our biggest snowfall of the season. We had 8 inches of fresh snow. And so the afternoon before, they delivered a 2023 Cadillac CT4V Blackwing with the 6-speed manual transmission, which thankfully it was equipped with winter tires.
Woohoo!
Had, Michelin Pilot Sport Alpine tires, which proved to be very capable in snowy weather conditions. You know, they as long as the snow was not more than about wherever I was driving was not more than about say 4 inches deep, then you know they managed to get a pretty good grip on everything and did really well. You know, obviously, you know, with a vehicle like this, if it's got, you know, more, if it's the snow is deeper than that, you're just not going to have enough ground clearance to go anywhere. And you know, I have
just plow into you stuff here.
I have. Or assuming you can even get started, you know, I have in the past, a few years back, I had an Alfa Romeo Giulia Stelvio that was delivered to me while I was in Chicago for the auto show. And that day when I was on the train coming back, we got a 10-inch snowfall, and that thing really struggled to get through the neighborhood. It was not good. You know, and again, it wasn't because of lack of grip from the tires. It's just, you know, not enough ground clearance. Nothing you can do about that. Let's see. The Blackwing is, you know, really what the CT4V just should have been, period, from the beginning. I had one of these last summer, early last summer or last spring, with the 10-speed automatic transmission. This one had the 6-speed manual, which is quite lovely. This has a 3.6-liter twin-turbo V6 with 472 horsepower, 445 foot-pounds of torque, and with the six-speed, you know, the six-speed is a great transmission in here. It's a Tremec six-speed with a Luke twin-disc clutch. You know, so it should be plenty robust enough to transfer that power and be able to withstand lots of hard launches with this thing. I didn't do much in the way of hard launches because of the snowy conditions. And I mostly put the drive mode in snow and ice, which kind of backs off on the aggressiveness of the throttle input. So you know, when you're stepping on the accelerator pedal, it doesn't give you quite as much power as it would if you're in sport or track mode, something like that. But you know, this thing is a lot of fun to drive. You know, when I did find some roads where the snow had been cleared and the pavement was had dried off, it was definitely a lot of fun. So, you know, these do come standard when you buy the Blackwing with Michelin Pilot Sport 4S summer tires. You know, this one was, you know, the fleet company had switched it over to the Pilot Sport Alpine winter tires, which, as I said, was grateful for. Big Brembo brakes, front and rear. I personally like the size of the CT4. You know, the back seat is a little tight. I can sit, you know, with the front seat positioned for my frame, I can sit behind myself, you know, and my knees aren't really rubbing against the front seat. But it's probably not someplace where you want to take a really long road trip for an adult. But I'm partial to this more compact size. You know, it's about, you know, 3 Series, BMW 3 Series, Audi A4 sized. It's rear-wheel drive, no all-wheel drive in this one. And this is probably the last that we'll see of a car like this. You know, this generation, the CT4 Blackwing and the CT5 Blackwing are the last ones that we'll see like this from Cadillac. You know, when these fade away, they will probably be replaced by something that is battery electric, which will probably be quicker, but won't have quite the engagement you get from this twin turbo V6.
There's something about the visceral, like the sort of visceral response that you get from a car that you know, is a manual and that, that sounds good. You can't get the sound. I don't care how they, how many fake sounds they put into an EV. I don't care what they make it sound like. I mean, it could sound like the Starship Enterprise. I don't care. I kind of want it to, I want a car. I'm going to miss it when you don't have that grr from a car. I'm going to miss that, Sam.
You just got to make the noise with your mouth now.
Just got to say the grr. Yeah, grr. Like channel my inner 12-year-old and make car sounds. Is that what I have to do?
Yeah, exactly.
No, that's what I do.
Biggest complaint I had about this one, and I actually forgot to mention it a few weeks ago when I was driving the CT5, is the seat controls, the power seat controls for the front seats. On the side of the seat between the seat and the door panel, you'll find the usual controls for moving the seat forward and back and adjusting the seat back angle. But then there's a rotary controller combined with a rocker in there for adjusting the lumbar support and things like that. And it's kind of weird because you can't see it. There's a tab on there on the rotary part of it that when you reach down and rotate it, the seat controls come up on the screen, the center touch screen, and you rotate the knob to go between adjusting the lumbar support, you know, where you want the lumbar support, you know, in terms of height and how much you want it inflated, or selecting the seat massager. And when I was with my wife in the CT5, it's got the same kind of controls on there for the seats. And she, you know, we were in the car and I was trying to explain to her how to turn. She said, "How do I turn on the seat massage in this thing?" And I'm trying to explain it to her.
Well, that's a problem.
It was just impossible.
Let me explain how this works.
So
first,
just reach down there. See that? You feel that round controller there? Okay. Now twist that. Twist it forward. Okay. Twist it forward again. So that's how you toggle between the different settings on the screen. Is you twist it forward or twist it back? You know, and then you press the rockers. You know, if you're in the lumbar support part of it, you press the rocker one way, you inflate the lumbar support, you press it the other way, it deflates it. And for the massager, you can change the pattern. It's just a pain in the neck. It's just a bad, bad, bad design. Very bad human factors design there.
Fair.
That's really my only complaint about this car. You know, other than that, you know, I was quite happy driving it, even in winter weather conditions. It's EPA rated at 15 miles per gallon city, 23 highway, 18 combined. You know, I actually got about 20, combined. So I did a little better than label, which is unusual for a car like this, but you know, again, you know, because of the weather conditions, I wasn't driving it especially hard, it's just a really nice car to drive. The CT4 Blackwing starts at $60,495 with the options that I had. I had the Sky Cool Gray exterior.
Wait, that was an option to get gray?
Sky Cool Gray.
It's
not
gray.
It's Sky Cool Gray.
Yeah. Not only is it an option, it's a very expensive option. Sky Cool Gray with jet black accents, with leather seating surfaces, suede microfiber wrapped trim package. That's also known as Alcantara. A high performance steering wheel. That is a $4,900 option.
No. All of that is not something you should get. Alcantara is the worst.
This one also had the performance data and video recorder. So if you're taking it to the track, you know, basically it uses the front camera, as a dash cam and there's a slot for a USB or I think it's an SD card, you can put in the glove box. That's $1,600 and it records along with recording the view from the front camera. It also overlays it with a bunch of telemetry data about what gear you're in and engine speeds and all, you know, all kinds of other stuff that you can select on there. So that's $1,600 if you want that. Then a few
which
other
you'll
options.
Never use, but
yeah, A few other options. Came to a grand total of $70,950. Any guesses on the delivery charge?
$1,300.
I was going to say $1,495 at the same time. $1,495 and stick with it.
Okay. $1,395.
Oh.
So Robbie got it again.
Okay. Cha-cha-cha. We were right in the middle. We were pretty close. Either one of us on either side. Oh, be quiet, you.
Yeah, that Sky Cool Gray metallic is a very pale gray. It looks almost white.
Okay.
You know.
Yeah.
Fine.
It's a sadness.
But, I like the look of the CT4. I like driving the Blackwing. It's a lot of fun.
Every day is like Sunday gray.
Yeah. All right. Let's get into a few other items we had on the list this week. Let's see. First off, the IRS.
I don't want to talk about the IRS because I did my taxes this morning and I'm done with the IRS. I'm logging off this podcast. I'm done.
No, but they did something good.
No, they didn't. They're the IRS. I find this inconceivable, but go ahead.
So they actually, a few weeks back, we were talking about this when they published the list of vehicles, which vehicles were eligible for the new clean vehicle credit and what price threshold they were at. And if you remember from the Inflation Reduction Act, cars are limited, are price capped at $55,000 and SUVs and trucks at $80,000. And there were some really unusual choices for which vehicles would be classified how on the original list published by the IRA a couple of weeks ago. For example, the VW ID4, mm-hmm. two-wheel drive ID4s are classed as cars subject to a $55,000 price cap. All-wheel drive models were capped at $80,000. Why?
That totally makes no sense.
The Cadillac Lyriq, very clearly a crossover SUV, you know, it was classified as a car. The IRS got a lot of grief from this. They actually listened.
I bet.
They got a lot of pushback from automakers and from other people. So they went back and decided what they should have done in the first place was they said, okay, we're just going to use the EPA classifications for these models. So however the EPA classifies each of these vehicles, whatever vehicle category they put them in, that's the category we'll use.
Which makes sense.
So now all crossovers and SUVs, you know, are classified as crossovers and SUVs and subject to the $80,000 price cap, and cars at $50,000 or $55,000. So if you're thinking about getting something now, it makes a little bit more sense.
And I mean, it makes sense in the sense that this should be the same price for both. But that's a whole other argument that I'm not going to win with the IRS and the IRA.
No one ever wins an argument with the IRS, and nothing ever makes.
Oh, I have. I've
had
the
IRS.
Yeah, they sent us a letter once saying that my wife wasn't in school. They're like, well, you can't. We need proof, or you owe us $500. And because my wife used to be a file clerk, I just like went over to the little to our file cabinet, and pulled the paper, made a copy, sent it off, and they're like, oh, well, with this, we owe you an extra $1,500, and then we got extra money.
Okay.
So yeah, keep good records.
Thanks to the IRS, but sometimes it's the weirdest. I always feel, I don't know. I love you IRS people listening to this. Please don't audit me. I just have issues. I have always a challenge.
Okay. So that's that. I alluded to something earlier when you were talking about the Palisade. There's been some reports over recent months that older Hyundai and Kia vehicles are very easy to steal. And in fact, some insurance companies are even saying that we're not going to provide insurance for certain Hyundai and Kia models because they're so easy to steal. And it turns out that back in the early mid-90s, they started on a bunch of cars, they started using an immobilizer system. So what they started doing was in the key. And you remember when cars used to actually have physical keys that you had to stick in a keyhole and
turn it
and
twist it
to start the car?
Olden
days, yes.
Yeah. Back in the 90s, they started putting a little chip in that key. And there was also a chip in the steering column. And when you put the key in, it had to match. And if it didn't match, the car wouldn't start. The engine wouldn't start when you turned the key. So even if you had the right profile on the key, you could turn the key, but it wouldn't actually start the car unless those chips matched. Mm-hmm. Well, it turns out that while most automakers, in fact, I think something like 96% of all new cars now have that chip immobilizer system, even on cars that still have a key, Hyundai and Kia apparently, as recently as 2021, most of their cars that still had keys were not equipped with this, which means that it was pretty trivially easy to steal these cars. You know, smash the window, stick a screwdriver in the key or in the lock cylinder, pry something out, give it a twist, and then drive away with the car. So I think Allstate and State Farm both said that they're not going to provide insurance for those vehicles anymore.
Wow.
in some states. And I guess where this really came out, where it really became well known, last fall, some people on TikTok started posting videos showing how easy it was to break in and steal these Hyundai and Kia vehicles.
As you do.
Yeah, as of course.
Well,
yeah.
You know, to be fair, my daughter goes to school in Milwaukee, and they actually sent, like, the, I don't know, safety services or whatever at her college sent a thing saying, hey, guys, just as a heads up, if you drive Hyundai or Kia, be really aware, do this, do that. There's a big theft issue. It's a huge issue there right now, to the point that, like, guys, don't, if you have one of these and you don't have to bring it to campus, please don't. Like, and this was issued a little while ago, that they were having problems with people just walking away with them. So I knew about this because of the, thank you, MSOE security department, for notifying everybody, like, be careful. If you're driving one of these, they can get stolen pretty easily.
Yeah, something like, I think 66% of all the cars stolen in Milwaukee last year were Hyundai and Kia models that fell into this category. And in Florida, more than 40% of all car thefts have been Hyundais and Kias. So,
once it goes viral, everyone knows how to do it. What are you doing this weekend? You know what? I was watching this TikTok. I think I'm going to steal a Kia.
Hyundai.
Let's go steal a Kia or Hyundai. I've always wanted a Rio.
Now,
I've just been dying for a Kia Rio. Let's go get ourselves one over there. I want one now.
none of this actually applies to any vehicles that have a push button start. So, you know, that Palisade, that $50,000 Palisade, you're golden. No problem.
There you go.
Thank goodness.
But if you've got, you know, an older Accent or Rio or anything like that, you know, from 2011 to 2021, they are apparently trivially easy to abscond with.
That's rough.
Hyundai actually is offering a $170 kit. You actually have to pay for it.
Ooh.
But
I mean, it's an old car, I guess. Never mind.
I know. So they kind of are giving you, like...
Yeah, but, you know, I mean...
Yeah,
they,
yes. I mean...
They cheaped out on not putting this immobilizer in there.
Yeah, a long time ago.
Yeah.
And there are multiple class action lawsuits underway.
Are there really?
So it'll probably be free if you wait.
Yeah. But by that time, your car will probably be
Your
stolen,
car's gone, so. But it'll be free to get the kit.
You know what?
The car you no longer have.
Let's reintroduce the club, everyone.
Yeah.
It's a bar.
That's what Kia is doing. Kia is they're not doing this kit. They're just giving away a free steering wheel lock. So basically a club. I don't know what brand it is, but the same basis.
Oh, there you go.
So if you have a Kia with a key, you know, go to your local Kia dealer, ask for one of these free steering wheel locks. You know, Hyundai owners, you'll have to pony up $170 for a kit plus whatever the cost of installation is, which could be up to $500.
Yeah, that's not going to be cheap.
Yeah, so be careful out there. Be careful where you park your Hyundai or Kia with a key. All right, let's see what else we had here. Ford and Red Bull made a big announcement this week. Ford's getting back into Formula One with Red Bull.
Woohoo!
Oh, man.
Woohoo!
I guess.
I only watch the TV show. I'm sorry. I tried to get into.
To Survive.
Yeah, I watched the TV show. I like the TV show. I as a child, I tried to get into watching sports, and I just couldn't get into major sports. And then I was like, well, I like to snowboard and ski and skateboard and surf. So I'll watch those. Nope, don't care. I just I can't watch things on TV that are sports. I just don't care enough. But good job.
Yeah, I mean, Jim Farley was on stage in New York this week with the boss from Red Bull, Christian Horner, and their drivers to announce that starting in 2026, Ford was going to be supplying the hybrid system for the Red Bull powertrains powertrain on the Red Bull and AlphaTauri F1 cars. So, you know, Ford's not going to do the engines. They're just going to do the electrification component of it. So that with the next generation cars starting in 2026, they're upping the performance of the electric component of it. So currently, the current F1 cars have 160 kilowatt motors, electric motors. They're going to be bumping that up to 350 kilowatts.
Wow.
That's about 500 horsepower of electric power.
Those things don't weigh anything.
they're actually a lot heavier than they used to be. They're actually up close to almost double what they used to be when I was young and I first started watching F1.
Yeah, but those were just murder mobiles.
Yeah, they weighed about 1,000 pounds back in the 70s. Now they're almost 2,000 pounds. So.
Which is... The battery on the Hummer weighs more than the entire car.
Between the turbo V6 and the hybrid drive, you know, they'll have about 1,000 horsepower.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And then, let's see, VinFast is – they've delayed their deliveries again. They had hoped to deliver some vehicles in December when they unloaded the ship in Long Beach. They didn't, and apparently they've delayed it again. Apparently they've been listening to you, Nicole, and they're
what are they doing? What's their? Let me see.
They're working on software updates and other stuff.
Good. Don't come out with a bad car. Yeah.
I
just
really
hold.
Just
wait.
As much as like you hate to hear that there's been a delay, honest to God, I'm happy for them because like make it right before you give it to us. Because if you give us the car,
especially when it's your first product,
that's just it. If you give us the car and the car is not right, your first perception by the public is going to be bleh, and it's hard to overcome that. Even if you fix whatever the issue is, you've got to get it out of the gate. So I'm hopeful that will help them come out of the gate a little bit stronger in the U.S. This makes me weirdly happy that they've delayed. Like, good, delay it if it's not ready. Just
make
up.
It right. Yeah,
yes,
don't
it right.
I mean, Volkswagen is still like reeling from putting out cars with bad software.
Exactly.
And it's Volkswagen. So, I mean, they've been making cars
who
for
people know
1 billion
and they, relatively
years.
Speaking, trust.
Yeah, just make it make it
within
make
a range
it as good
of,
as possible, and then bring it out. Just delay it if you have to. Some people, it's fine.
And then one last one. I think I can't remember if it was last week or the week before. We talked about Motor Trend, or it was last week. Yeah, when you weren't here, Robbie, we talked about a story in Motor Trend that Christian Seba did. He got an estimate for installing the Ford Lightning home integration system in his house, which came to about $18,000.
Wait, what?
Yeah. He had a worst case scenario.
Yeah.
Yeah, he had a 1950s house with a detached garage and 100-amp service. So he would have had to get a new service panel, new breaker panel, bump it up to 200 amps. He had overhead power lines going between the house and the garage. So he would have had to get that trenched to run the lines to the garage and a whole bunch of other rewiring. So it would have been about 18 grand.
It really is like the worst possible.
Okay. That's on one hand, I'm like, what?
It was not like your average thing. It was like, everything has gone wrong. This is how much you.
Yeah, everything's gone off the rails.
Everything that could go wrong, except
like
for
we're
like
using,
throwing in like a zombie apocalypse.
We're using pennies.
Yeah.
We're using pennies to there's a bunch of pennies in my boat. You're like, what? Don't do that.
Yeah.
Remember that was a thing?
So Tom Maloney, who does the State of Charge YouTube channel, actually did a video, and I'm not sure when he actually published this. It looks like a couple of weeks ago. He actually went through and explained. He had this installation done at his house, and went through and explained the whole thing and breaks it all down. Breaks down what all the costs are. It's about a half hour long video, but if you're interested at all in this, you know it's worth watching this. I watched it the other day, and he. Tom's actually got a a shockingly complex setup in his house too. And it's kind of ridiculous.
Why does Tom, did he explain why it's more complex? Is it more complex than it needs to be, or is it more complex because it's Tom and yes. it's his job.
It's his job.
His
okay.
Job.
Okay.
Yeah, so he's got solar on the house. He's got other chargers there. He's got a Tesla wall box and, you know, various other things. And he's also got a Generac, natural gas and generator, whole house backup generator, you know, and so he was tying in the Ford system along with the natural gas generator.
God.
I mean, his setup, his installation ended up costing about $14,000, which is not as bad as what it would have been for Christian.
Wait, does that include like the solar and everything?
No, the solar was all, he already
okay,
had.
Okay,
all the electrical work.
All the insane stuff that he has.
Yeah.
But zombie apocalypse, we're all going to Tom's.
That's right. Exactly.
Exactly.
He will be the one person that still has power.
He's going to be ready.
If you watch The Last of Us episode 3.
When the cordyceps, you know, mutate and can start to take over our brains, we're all heading to Tom's.
We're all heading to Tom's. See, that's my goal is to have that. But not like that. We're gonna have solar. We're gonna have V2L in our house at some point. But yeah, not
he
all.
He does. He does go through the explanation of, you know, here are, you know, other more basic configurations, more standard configurations, and basically what it comes down to is at the low end, you're looking at about $7,500, you know, because it's $4,000 for the Sunrun integration kit. And then probably about another $3,500 to $4,000 for a basic installation, And then as things get more complex, then it obviously
gets more expensive. Does this include? Well, I guess every state has different like incentives. Like California, like you can get stuff for like half.
Yeah,
off, blah, blah, blah.
I don't know if any of the incentives would cover something like this though. I mean, they cover things
the
like solar.
Power. If you put it depends. Like California, if you put a charger on your house, there's an incentive. If you do this, yeah. So it's your cost may vary based on where you live.
According to incentive systems. One thing I did notice from the video, one of the things he had done, you know, he previously had a 150-amp service panel. He had that replaced with 400-amp service.
Oh, my gosh.
And so he's got two 200-amp panels.
Oh my gosh.
Tom's living the dream.
I don't know what he's running that requires that much power.
He's
future-proofing.
Ready.
He's
like,
future-proofing, though.
Yeah, I guess, because, you know.
He's going to be
in the future.
He's going to start. Tom's house is going to be a charging station at some point.
You're just going to drive up, charge your car, drive away.
Yeah. His gas generator puts out 15 kilowatts, plus you get 9 kilowatts from the truck. You know, so you're looking at 24 kilowatts of power that you can get to your house. And he still, I guess the way he described it, he still doesn't actually have everything in the house hooked up to this, which makes me wonder what he's doing, because, you know, I looked it up. The average American household consumes about a peak between about 1 to 3 kilowatts of power. That's the total. That's the continuous power consumption. About 1 to 3 kilowatts.
So about 30 kilowatts a day, 25 to 30 kilowatts a day.
Yeah, the average is actually, according to the Energy Information Agency, is about 29.5 kilowatt hours a day.
All right.
Is the average electrical consumption for American household.
Okay.
And, you know, the peak power consumption is between 1 and 3 kilowatts. And I know when we had our power outage last fall and Ford sent over a Lightning and I plugged everything in, you know, I plugged in two refrigerators and a bunch of lights and assorted other stuff, and it was still pulling, you know, like half a kilowatt. So,
it's like,
most people are, you know, I think unless you are running, you know, a Bitcoin mining farm in your basement,
that's how Tom's making his cash.
The kind of power
that's
that Tom's
what he's doing.
Right.
I am hoping that I see Tom on the next. Like, he's a really nice guy. He's very smart, and he does a really good job of sort of explaining like all these things, like all like electricity. I really want to sit down and be like, so.
I know. I'm
your house,
man.
What's going on?
but hopefully, anyway, you know. regardless of that, he does a really good job of walking through, you know, what all this stuff is. What are the components? What are they doing? And here's, you know, some different configurations. And what does it cost? You know, and shows you the cost for, like I said, a basic setup versus kind of an all-in thing like he did. So you can get a better understanding of what all this stuff means. So that video, I'll have a link to it in the show notes.
Cool.
And then, let's see. We had a couple of questions, comments. Jeff D in the Discord asked, and this is also IRS related, would a used Kona EV priced under $25,000 qualify for a federal tax credit on used EVs? What are the restrictions on used EVs regarding point of assembly and battery sourcing? Fortunately, for used EVs, it's a lot simpler than it is for new EVs. There are no restrictions on point of assembly or battery sourcing. So it doesn't matter if it was built in Korea or China or Timbuktu. They all qualify. Yes, the Kona EV, if you can find a used Kona EV for under 25 grand, you're good. That basically the only restrictions, and I'll have a link to the page that describes this. For the used EVs, the income cap is cut in half compared to new vehicles. So for new vehicles, it's $300,000 annual income for married filing jointly, or $150,000 for single filers. If you're buying a used EV, it's $150 for joint filing and $75 for single filing. The cars have to be at least 2 years old. They have a full list of all the cars that qualify. So it can be any eligible fuel cell or plug-in EV. That can be battery electric or plug-in hybrid. For the plug-ins, they have to have a battery of at least 7 kilowatt hours. So like the original first generation Toyota Prius plug-in would not qualify because that was only like 4 kilowatt hours. The Prius Prime qualifies. So 2 years old, and you have to be the second owner. After the second owner, the third owner, fourth owner cannot qualify.
You can't sell it to your cousin. Right. And then he sells it to his cousin, and then he sells it to his cousin.
And one other thing, you do have to buy it from a dealer. Because the dealer's got to process all the stuff. So no private party sales.
I can't sell you my Kona.
Yeah.
I'm just going to tell you that the Mini SE qualifies. The Mini SE is just there a great, go. Fun little EV for around town and just tearing it up in there back roads if you live near back roads. Cars qualify. I don't know.
Adam J. on Mastodon had a couple of things. He said, curious if he was referring to Consumer Reports, if they've tested or will be testing Mercedes Drive Pilot Level 3 now that it's legal in the U.S. and how it is. So Kelly already answered that. No, they have not evaluated that yet. And it's actually not technically legal yet. It's not available yet. There's several steps in the approval process. Nevada gave the first phase of that approval. So it probably won't be available till sometime later this year.
We'll get it once we get it.
Adam also had a comment on the Polestar 2, which we talked about last week. He said, just listen to this episode on the updated Polestar 2. I know your only complaint is the high belt line, but I would like to add an additional one that was actually the deal breaker for us. The center console still only has one usable cup holder, and you have to lose your armrest and storage just to use the second one. I hadn't thought about this when I drove it. But yeah, the second cup holder is hidden under the armrest, which you have to flip up to use the second cup holder. Can't figure out how that made it through multiple model years, including the significant refresh. I guess if you need two cup holders, then that would be problematic.
Automakers underestimate the importance of a good cup holder, which is there's some car, I feel like it was a Subaru, there was it the Ascent, there's like 18 cup holders or something, and they were all excited. I'm like, that feels like almost enough.
Just enough, because you have a drink for now and then a drink for later.
Right, and everybody needs a drink for now and a drink for later. So, you need all those very many spots to hold all the variety of drinks.
And you need, spots, for big water bottles and, for your massive what do you call those things from 7-Eleven?
Like Big Gulp.
Big Gulp,
is that what it is at 7-Eleven, yes. I think? Big Gulp.
Yeah. Mega Gulp.
Okay. Finally, E. Butler on.
Okay, wait, I'm going to take this one. So
okay,
this is to me. So E. Butler sent us an email and he said, "Hi there, I'm a Japanese listener and I've been enjoying your show for a couple of years. Particularly, I love to listen to what you all three think of Japanese cars. In any event, I have a little tiny suggestion as to a Japanese word in episode 268. I hope you won't be offended. I'm not. With my suggestion, when Nicole-san talked about the color of the Mazda, the word that I couldn't say, he thought I didn't sound right. So basically, he gave me a pronunciation guide.
And you're assuming it's a he.
Oh, I don't know. Mikami? Oh, she. He, she gave me a pronunciation guide for how to say this. I was saying, I think, Takuminuri. I didn't know how to say it. So this person has laid out exactly how to say it, and it was about the color. And if I got it right, it's Takuminuri. Is how it should have been said, which doesn't look at all like what the word looks like to me as an English speaker. I don't know if I even came remotely closer to that, but is that how you would say it, Sam, looking at his breakdown?
I think it's
based on the description in here.
Kumi.
And the RI at the end there, because Japanese, you know, doesn't have that distinction between R and L the way we do in English. You know, they've got it here, you know, as L-Y as the pronunciation.
Right.
So newly, you know, although it would, you know, I don't want to offend anyone. And so I'm not going to try and pronounce it as a native Japanese speaker might. The actual sound there, I think for that part is going to be more of a cross between an R and an L. But the rest of it, yeah, I think, you know, Takumi Nuri.
That's what I'm thinking. Yeah, and it says the stress should be on the first syllable of each of those sort of words. So it should be Takumi Nuri.
Yeah.
I'm guessing. So Mikami, I'm probably saying your name wrong too. Mikami, thank you for sending that in. Hopefully I pronounced the word a little bit better this time. Japanese is a tough language if you don't speak it because the sounds are very, very different. I wish you'd record how it sounded. You need to send us a little audio file.
Oh, every yeah. time we do anything, you know, just send us
for anyone that wants to send in questions, you know, if you want, you know, please feel free to, you know, record a question and put the audio file on Dropbox or, you know, wherever you like to store it. And send us a link, and we would be happy to play your question and include it in the show. For you know, everyone, you can send us your questions at feedback@wheelbearings.media or at on Mastodon. We're at wheelbearingscast@federated.press. Or you can send it to the Discord in the Discord as. Jeff did. He sent us a question in the Discord. So thanks, everybody. Great to talk to you all, and we'll talk to you next time.
Next time.
Bye.
Robbie's muted, so he can't say goodbye.
Bye. Sorry, the dog. Nico.
He was dealing with the dog.
Nico is very – she went out, and now she I'm not paying attention to her, so she just barks at me now. That's like her new thing. Like, you're not paying attention to me, so I'm going to bark at you. And she's like, ruff, 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 and then it just gets louder and louder. She's got crazy face, which she always kind of has. She's just sort of a crazy dog. I know. She's just like, why are we not having fun?
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.